You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartmann here with you. And we are broadcasting live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference here in Washington, D.C. And I'm honored to have with me Robert Reich. Robert Reich is the former cabinet secretary in U.S. Labor Secretary in the cabinet of the administration of Bill Clinton. Time magazine, in fact, said he was one of the 10 most successful cabinet secretaries in the century. He is currently a professor of public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley and the author of 13 books. His latest book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Robert Reich. It's an honor to have you back with us, sir.
Well, it's nice to see you, Tom. It's nice to see you in person.
Yeah, it is. It really
you
is.
You look actually very handsome, if I may say.
So do you, sir.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Thank you. First of all, the conference. There's a lot of great organizations here. You've played a major role in all of them. You want to give us just a couple of words about what's going on with this conference and some of the organizations that helped put it together?
Well, look, at
and your role in it?
I won't talk about my role, but let me just say that the Take Back American Dream movement, and it really is not just a conference, a movement, is part of a movement that is spreading across America. People who are just fed up and outraged with the power of large corporations and the power of Wall Street, and say, look, we're 99% of the population, and we have a terrible deal right now, and we've had a terrible deal for years, there's got to be some change, some fundamental change in the way our society is organized around work and wages and who gets what. It's just fundamentally unfair and immoral.
Yeah. And, you know, that aspect of morality is what I think is driving the Occupy Wall Street movements and the Occupy these various cities where people, as Fox News, I was watching Fox last night, it was actually the only station that was broadcasting news at the time, which is kind of tragic commentary in America. And they were talking about this and about, you know, that it smells like urine down in the park and they look like a bunch of hippies. And most importantly, they don't have a single demand. It seems to me like we're in one of those very pregnant moments, like before Tahrir Square in, I mix up my countries in the Middle East horribly, but where the young man self-immolated, was that Yemen?
Tom, I don't think this is going to be an American fall like the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. But I do think that people are desperate. The latest data we have show that 37% of American families with young children are now in poverty. 37%. This is a record.
More than a third.
That's more than one out of three American families with young children in poverty. At the same time that the rich are richer than ever. The top 1% is taking home over 20% of national income.
And over of the entire nation.
Of the entire nation. And has 35% of all of the wealth of the country right now. We haven't seen this since before the Great Depression. And it's not just the statistics. I could rattle off a lot of statistics for you and bore your listeners and television viewers completely silly. The point is that Americans have got to the point where they can no longer turn around and buy the things that they make. And that's why businesses are not hiring.
And in addition to that, they're not making them anymore, by the way.
Well, exactly.
We've got some trade policy
problems.
But even
services.
Monetary policy problems.
Even the services that used to provide a lot of American jobs.
Yeah.
Retail, restaurant, hotel, hospital, surface transportation, child care, elder care, teachers, everything else.
Right.
I mean, all of these jobs are under siege right now. And that means people who have the jobs and others who depend on them are in a tighter and tighter and tighter place.
This sounds to me like the prescription for a downward spiral, which is sometimes referred to as a depression, a deflationary cycle. Do you see that? And if so, how do we break out of that?
Well, we are in a jobs depression. I don't think there's any question about it. And we break out of it. That is, it's a vicious cycle. And we break out of it by, first of all, relying on the purchaser of last resort, as we always have. And that must be
government.
That has to be. I mean, put ideology aside, Tom. When consumers cannot spend, when government, when businesses are not going to invest, then government has got to. But also, there is this issue of widening inequality. With so much income and so much wealth going to the very top, the vast American middle class, working class, poor, just doesn't have enough purchasing power to keep the economy going. And we have got to tackle directly the issue of widening inequality.
Well, not only that, I'm sure you're familiar with the Spirit Level, the work of Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett in the UK and the Equality Trust. We are now the most unequal society of the 34 OECD countries, and they scatter line graph them, and in a whole bunch of social indices, teenage pregnancies, sexually transmitted diseases, drug use, both illegal and prescription drug use, abuse, homicide, suicide, crime in general, failure to complete school, infant mortality, lifespan. All of these things get worse as inequality grows,
yes,
regardless of how rich
a
society is.
But here's the point. It doesn't have to be that way. We are. The United States is the richest country in the world. We are the richest country in the history of the human race. That we have so much poverty, that we have so many people who are not in poverty, but they are worried about how to pay the bills,
right,
where their next paycheck is going to come from. There's no excuse from this.
So if we agree that inequality is disastrous, both because the people don't, from an economic point of view, people don't have enough money to drive the economy, from an anthropological point of view, because it's a disaster, what do we do about that?
We start with, now I could give you a list of policies.
Yeah, my first would be roll back the Reagan tax cuts.
Well, yes, you roll back the tax cuts, you roll back, I mean, you know, you expand the earned income tax credit, which is a wage subsidy. You raise taxes on the very, very top to pay for it. You invest in education and infrastructure. But behind all the policies is a bigger issue. How do you change politics to get those policies?
Oh, boy.
And that's where mobilizing, energizing, organizing the vast American 99% comes in. I mean,
right,
people, nothing good happens in Washington, Tom. And I know this from my experience. Nothing good happens in Washington unless people outside Washington are energized, mobilized, and organized to demand that it happen. Otherwise, the special interests take over.
So that's us. That's here. That's this conference.
That's here. That's the mobilizations that are beginning around the country.
That's the people listening and viewing.
And that's a lot of people who are listening right now who are cynical, who say, well, nothing I do is going to make any difference.
Right.
Cynicism is the greatest enemy of social change. Because if people give up, then the other side wins.
And it seems that with everything from ALEC to newspapers and magazines being basically subsidized, all these right wing writers, their books hit the New York Times bestseller list because Richard Mellon Scaife goes in or whoever and buys 40,000 copies. Magazines like I believe the National Review is still losing money. The Washington Times has lost over $1 billion. Fox News lost $100 million a year for 5 years before they made any money. This incredible infrastructure seems dedicated, in the minute we have left, to demoralizing as well as to putting out the message.
Well, they're dedicated to two things. One is telling big lies, such as trickle-down economics,
right,
or you've got to shrink government to create jobs. I mean, this is absurd. But big lies said often enough have the effect of big lies. People start believing them. The second goal of the radical right is to demoralize and create cynicism among everybody else so that we do not respond.
Right.
And that is what today is all about. That's what the demonstrations around the country are all about. That's what we have got to, all of us, dedicate ourselves to in the years ahead. It's not going to be easy. But unless we are organized and mobilized, nothing fundamentally is going to change.
Right.
The right is going to prevail.
Right. And in general, the way it works is, when the parade going down the street gets big enough, the politicians start jumping in front of it with a flag saying, this is my parade.
Exactly.
And so it's got to be us doing the parade. Robert Reich, so glad to have you with us here, sir, today.
Tom, great to see you.
I do appreciate it. We'll be right back here on the Tom Hartman program and on Free Speech TV. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back
Tom Hartman here with you live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference here in Washington, D.C., a whole group of extraordinary organizations and people coming together to take back the American dream. And one of my favorites, one of my heroes, one of my friends, Jim Dean, is with us. He's the chairman of Democracy for America, DFA, democracyforamerica.com, one of the websites that you constantly hear me telling you to go to. And, Jim, welcome.
Tom, thanks for having me on. How are you?
Just great. You guys are still doing trainings around the country on how to be an activist?
Sure are. We actually just finally got to Anchorage, Alaska about 2 weeks ago. So we've got about four more states to go to, but we're going to still keep pushing this and,
More states before you've hit all 50?
Yeah.
Holy cow!
Yeah, so it's been a long haul at it, but we got to keep coming back. You know, we got to keep getting people involved and making it easier for people to take responsibility over the political process.
Have you become a frequent flyer miles junkie? Is that?
Well, I'm on a lot of different airlines, so they don't really treat me better. One doesn't treat me better than the other.
That's unfortunate. I've actually played that game for years. Anyway, the Take Back America movement, the Take Back the American Dream movement, actually, I think is, and that's an important distinction because, you know, pre-Reagan, we all understood that the American dream was the life that my dad and most of my friends' parents had. I grew up in Lansing, Michigan, a blue-collar working-class town. Mm-hmm. My dad worked in a tool and die shop. My next-door neighbor's dad worked at Oldsmobile. The guy across the street worked at Fisher Body. I mean, you know, that was and on that one single salary, you could raise a kid, raise a family, put your kids through college. My dad and mom had four sons, and have a pension and retire. Yep. How do we take back the American dream?
Well, I think it's a lot of different things all coming together at once. You know, you're seeing it with the spontaneous actions that are going on all over the country with the Occupy Wall Street. That's really important. These folks are keeping this thing alive, just like the folks in Wisconsin did in February and January of last year, which was very, very important. You're seeing labor with a renewed vigor right now, and it's not just within their membership. It's outside of their membership with a lot of people who are empathetic with the idea that if you work for a living in this country, you ought to be able to make a living. And they're empathetic with the fact that labor does offer the kinds of opportunities. It wants a society that offers not just a living wage, but opportunities for people to have advancement, opportunities for our kids. So you're seeing a resurgence there. And then, you know, listen, there are a lot of other great progressive groups out there right now offering different ways to get involved. But the important operative word here is get involved. It's not about one organization or another. It's about all of us taking back control of the political process and taking back control of our country from big business.
democracyforamerica.com, the website for your organization. I want to say that again because I want A, to people to go there, and B, I'd like to talk to you about beyond that, this conference, your participation in this conference, your sense of this conference. Why are you here? What do you see going on here?
Well, it's always helpful for us to be at places where there are other groups doing other work so we can understand that better and get a lot smarter about what's going on out there and also get smarter about how to be effective. You know, we were very, very involved in the Wisconsin recall elections. We just went up and giddy-apped over to Ohio, where we're working with a broad coalition of groups to repeal the anti-collective bargaining legislation that Governor Kasich passed.
This is SB 5.
SB 5. And kudos to the folks who got the voter suppression repeal on the ballot. That's not going to happen until 2012, but that's very important for this election.
Yep.
We have a lot of other opportunities in other states for forward-thinking legislation. You know, we're not about just fighting back against these folks. You know, we have a lot of states that are going to be setting up these healthcare exchanges, and that may include some of the government option stuff, as Vermont did in its bill last year.
Yeah. Montana, Governor Schweitzer came out last week or the week before saying he wants to do that.
Yeah, we have other states that are talking about public financing of elections, which in my home state of Connecticut has been a home run. For everybody.
But the Supreme Court just knocked that down in Arizona. Did they knock it down so narrowly that it could be done a different way? Or
they knocked it down basically because what they're saying is that you can't tell a candidate that they have to pay an extra penalty or that they can't spend all the money they want on an election. So, in fact, in Connecticut, for example, if you have $1 billion and want to run for legislature, you can do it. But the fact is, in two short cycles, Tom, what this has already done is created a culture among the voters where they don't really particularly appreciate candidates who are spending a lot of money on races, particularly when their opponents are taking public financing.
Right.
That's why Governor Malloy got elected over a free-spending Republican. And it's like one of the reasons why Richard Blumenthal won his race against
Lincoln. So you already have public funding in Connecticut?
Yeah, we've had it for two cycles.
I didn't know that.
And it's for the legislative races and the governor's races. Last year was the first governor's race that had been in place.
What's the threshold to get in? How many signatures, how many dollars do you need?
Well, in the legislative race, and this may have changed because it's going to change from one cycle to the next, but you had to raise $15,000 in $100 contributions. A lot of it had to come from within your district. You had to get a certain amount of signatures on the ballot, and then you qualify for an $85,000 grant. So instead of millions of dollars in a legislative race, we're basically having legislative contests for less than $100,000 right now.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And
it's taking all the big special interest money out of politics.
So what happens if, Karl Rove's GPS, whatever, comes in and just runs, $500,000 of the ads against somebody?
Well, Linda McMahon did the same thing against Richard Blumenthal last year, and Richard Blumenthal won. Tom Foley did it against Governor Malloy, and Governor Malloy won.
So do they get outed as a result of this process?
Sure.
Does the process increases the transparency?
And actually, the polling shows that people, when they start hearing these commercials, all they're being reminded of is that these opponents have a lot of money. It's becoming, and it happened to Meg Whitman in California.
Sure.
So if we could keep more states adopting this, we can get more states to adopt it, which is an opportunity next year, we could start dumbing down Citizens United in a different way. I'm for a constitutional amendment, but we got to get everybody on board with this.
Yeah, corporations are not people, money is not speech.
Right.
Amend the Constitution. Jim Dean, democracyforamerica.com is the website. That's FOR, Democracy for America. Jim,
thanks so much.
Always
Tom.
An honor to see you.
Appreciate it.
I hope you're doing well.
Yeah, we're doing good.
Keep up the great work.
Will do.
You're doing God's work, man. I'm really serious. Jim Dean from Democracy for America. We will be back in just a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We're live today at the Take Back the American Dream Conference here in Washington, D.C. More from some great folks here at the conference. Right after this. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Jacob, I didn't hear any bumper music. Oh, your computer crooked. Okay, got it. Okay. Let's pick up some of your phone calls, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Danny in Los Angeles. Hey, Danny, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was just thinking about how the Republicans and the Tea Partiers are wanting to cut government spending. And I thought, they stay at five-star hotels when they travel, and they're getting a per diem to live there in Washington, D.C. They should reject all that. They should be staying at Hotel 6 or the cheapest hotel available.
Who's the they that you're talking about?
The members of the House of Representatives, all the Republicans, the Tea Partiers, those that want to cut government spending.
Oh, yeah. There was, it's very interesting. There was in one of the states, I believe it was Florida. It was one of the, these Republican wackadoodle states. Might have been Ohio or Indiana. Saw the headline in passing yesterday. I'm sorry, I don't remember the state, but it was one of these states where there was a bill that would cut the pay and benefits to the state legislatures by 5%, and which was controlled by the Republicans. And this at the same time that they're laying off teachers and police officers. They said, no, we're not going to cut our own pay. It ain't going to happen. But I'm with you. I think that there's an excellent point to be made there. James in North Bend, Oregon. Hey, James, what's up?
Good morning, sir. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. And you?
Fine, thank you. What about all this? This is a Democrat march by the Democrats, by the unions. Aren't there any conservatives there or any other types of people that have different political views? The way you make it painted.
First of all, I'm not talking about a march. We're at a conference. And, there might be conservative groups here. I doubt it. I've done this show from...
About the march in New York,
right?
That you've been speaking about just recently.
Oh, and yeah, sure.
Okay,
I don't think that's a Democratic Party march. In fact, I would, to the best of my knowledge, the only Democratic Party politician who has shown up was Charlie Rangel. And that was, you know, after, what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks? This is absolutely, this is no more the Democratic Party than the Tea Party was the Republican Party. And in fact, the Tea Party started with, you know, the Koch brothers endowing this thing with millions of dollars. Dick Armey, the multimillionaire Dick Armey, with his Tea Party organization, endowing it with millions of dollars. And those organizations, you know, once they, and I mean, you know, for example, who paid for the big fancy buses with Tea Party Express painted all over the side of them, or Tea Party this or Tea Party that? Who paid for the big jumbotrons and the thing for all those Tea Party events? Who paid the millions of dollars to the PR firms in Los Angeles, New York, and D.C. that made sure that they got the media coverage? I guarantee you it wasn't the average Tea Partier. The average Tea Partier was sucked into all that stuff and, you know, thus the Tea Party. But this is the other way around. This is very much not a top. Oh, and by the way, Fox News pushing the Tea Party from day one. This is very much a different thing. This is from the bottom up. And so, you know, for you to call and say, oh, this is a Democrat thing. First of all, there is no Democrat Party. I know Republicans like you and partisans like Frank Luntz. Well, actually, this was Newt Gingrich's big thing back in the 1980s, was don't ever refer to it as the Democratic Party, because that sounds democratic. And people like democratic. That's a good word. Refer to it as the Democrat Party and emphasize the rat at the end. Well, there is no such thing as a Democrat Party. There's the Democratic Party. And but that said, the Democratic Party has nothing to do with what's going on in New York City. I hope, personally, that they will. But so far they don't. They haven't. They've been staying as far away from it as they can. And whereas, meanwhile, you've seen Republicans embracing the Tea Party like there's no tomorrow. So, anyhow, Grant in Benton City, Washington. Hey, Grant, what's on your mind?
Oh, well, actually, I'm kind of going to ride the coattails of the previous couple of callers and kind of get more pointed about it. I'm really interested in how I can get my belief in the American political system back, because I've completely lost it. After the debacle with Barack Obama coming into office and completely letting down the progressive base that got him elected.
It wasn't a total debacle, and he didn't completely let us down. I'm sure either one of us could recite the list of complaints and concerns about him, but he also got a fair amount of good stuff done, largely with the help of Nancy Pelosi. I would say if there was a failure of the Obama administration and of Barack Obama himself, it was the failure to use the bully pulpit of the White House.
Well, and it was also the failure of Congress during the first half, where they had the control of it, to progress any kind of democratic agenda. It seemed like they were basically focused on bipartisanship.
There was a bunch of very, very good progressive legislation that was passed out of the House of Representatives. More than 220 bills Nancy Pelosi got out, including bills that would have shut down foreign factories and brought them back home, that would have done away with the tax incentive, to move our jobs overseas. A whole lot of very good and very progressive legislation that just died in the Senate because of the filibuster, and because the Democratic majority in the Senate, well, it wasn't even a majority toward the end, was not large enough to overcome a filibuster, number one. And number two, even if it had been, there are still, you know, dinos like Ben Nelson in the Senate.
So we need to basically go through and vote them all out? Because it seems like there's some kind of a machine where when any of these really idealistic, quote, progressive candidates get into Washington, they drink some sort of magical potion that turns them into, you know, embracers of the status quo. I don't see many people shaking it up too very much right now.
Well, you've got almost 100 members in the Democratic Progressive Caucus, in the Democratic Party's Progressive Caucus. You've got a Save Social Security in the House. It was founded by Bernie Sanders and Peter DeFazio. You've got in the United States Senate the equivalent of a Progressive Caucus that was founded by Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown, I believe, called the Save Social Security Coalition or Caucus. You have... Again, not everybody goes nuts. There are 435 members of the House, and the largest single caucus in the Democratic Party, the largest single group of people in the Democratic Party, in the House of Representatives, not the Blue Dogs, not the Yellow Dogs, not the Pro-Life Caucus, none of the above. It's the Progressive Caucus. So we've got a good start. We've got a good foundation.
Well, but how come, I mean, there's obviously some discontent, or a disconnect, rather, beyond the discontent. There's people in the streets of New York City, Portland, Oregon, all these other places that feel completely unrepresented.
Yep. Yes, I agree.
So what do we have to do to make this go away? I mean, I want to
We have to make make the protests larger and louder and more ubiquitous, and absolutely adhere to the principles of nonviolence and you know, not violating laws beyond, you know, passive resistance to laws that we consider unjust. And those things eventually, as Jim Dean and I were talking about, Robert Reich and I were talking about, those things will eventually create a parade going down the street that is so big that every politician in America is going to want to jump out in front, put up a flag, and say, this is my parade. That's what happened with the Tea Party. When the Koch brothers and Dick Armey were able to make the Tea Party large enough, politicians all over America jumped out in front of it and said, oh, I'm a Tea Party guy. We've got to have the 99 percenters, this group of the other 99% of us. That party has to be big enough that people will want to participate. David in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, what's up? And listen, I got an idea, but I don't know if it would work. Actually protest right in front of the Koch brother industries, but protest in front of all these grassroots things as well, occupy them as well.
Well,
and the other thing is to demand Social Security become a right, an actual right, a civil right, meaning never can be touched.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think that, you know, first of all, in order to use the word right, you'd have to somehow get it into the Constitution. That would require an amendment to the Constitution. I think, though, that, or, you know, maybe you could pass a law saying that, you know, under the General Welfare Clause, we now consider these to be rights. This is what Franklin Roosevelt tried to do with his second New Deal about a year before he died. And
one more thing that I got to say also, once the table that's happened, there's a Facebook page that was hijacked by the Tea Party. It was an anti-Tea Party group called the Tea Party Doesn't Represent Me. It was hijacked by a right-winger saying all kinds of cursing and racist things on there.
Right.
Isn't that horrible?
It is, and there are, you know, there are nasty tactics on both sides, and there's been no shortage of them. But, you know, I think that, you know, staying true to the principles, staying true to the ideals, showing up and participating is the key. David in New York City. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, nice to talk to you again. Yeah, I'm just reporting from the front lines here. Well, people don't really understand that this is morphing into a labor union, a labor movement that's going to make Wisconsin look like nothing. Everybody's joining up. And what's really going to be interesting, Tom, is when it gets out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And once the Teamsters get involved, then the cops aren't going to want to do anything. Trust me on that one.
No, it's their union, isn't it?
Pardon me?
It's their union, isn't it?
I believe so. And they control everything in New York. I mean, they can stop New York like on a dime.
Yeah.
And when that happens, guess what they'll have to do to control the crowds?
What's that?
You remember from the 60s.
Oh. Yeah, well, you know, that really only happened once at Kent State, and
I'm not talking about murdering, but I'm talking about calling out the National Guard.
Oh, yeah, well, you can't call out the National Guard. They're in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, they got
I'm being facetious, but yeah, you're right, and this is already happening. I mean, I thought it was really interesting, the piece, there was a thread about this on DU yesterday, where somebody had done a screen capture of the New York Times. And in a 20-minute period, the caption under the photo of the New York Times Online of the protesters arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge went from police allowed protesters to cross the bridge, then closed it and began arresting them, to police arrest protesters as they illegally crossed the Brooklyn Bridge. In other words, history got rewritten by the New York Times in 20 minutes online, and thank God somebody caught it. But I think you're right, David. This is a movement that is sweeping America. And nobody owns it, nobody controls it, and some politicians better get out in front of it and start getting with the program quick.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're at the Take Back the American Dream Conference here in Washington, D.C. Great list of organizations participating. More of your calls right after this.
Dreaming.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference in Washington, D.C., an extraordinary coalition of organizations and groups, which I will share with you later once I get the list, Louise. In fact, oh, hey, surprise, I got the list. America Votes, Power Pack, Change, Demos, that's a long list. We'll share it at more length. Anyhow, Norman Solomon is with me right now. Norman Solomon is an American writer. He is an American journalist, author, candidate for Congress from California in the newly formed District 2, and founded the Institute for Public Accuracy and served as its director until 2010. His website, Solomon, O-M-O-N, 4-F-O-R, congress.com. Right? Norman,
yes.
Welcome.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to have you with us. Tell me, what's going on in the conference here? Why are you here?
Well, it's a vortex of energy. I think there's a recognition of opportunity and also, frankly, crisis, that not only is the country apparently in overall an economic tailspin, but also a sort of a political morass epitomized by Washington, D.C. And, frankly, the Democratic Party's in crisis. It doesn't have its own voice clear, sort of every which way, trying to be a lot of things to a lot of people and not doing a heck of a lot good, frankly.
200 pieces of legislation Nancy Pelosi got out of the House, died in the Senate. Parts of the Democratic Party are trying to do some good.
Well, there are efforts, but in terms of a clear voice and a strategy, it's very unclear. The accommodation process has been now multi-year. Getting up in the morning, the Republicans are a wall that is immovable, so moving partway to that wall. Then after there's a cycle of legislation, getting up in the morning, the wall hasn't moved, and then moving again towards that wall.
Yeah.
We've been experiencing that for years, literally. And the result is that we're not digging in as Democrats, as progressives, effectively in the electoral arena or on Capitol Hill to say, this is our bottom line. Medicare is untouchable. Social Security is untouchable. We do not believe in trickle-down economics. We do not believe in trickle-down job creation. We need a huge federal jobs program.
Right. Yeah. For example, as a start. What are the organizations that you see doing? You know, here's why I'm asking this question. One of the most common questions and calls that I get is, what can I do? Who should I join? Where do I show up?
Yes, and I often get that question on the campaign trail and elsewhere. What is the one thing I should be doing? And my answer is, there is no one thing you should be doing. That a healthy ecology of movement, just like a healthy forest, has so many different aspects. Do what you can do where you are, out of commitment, out of passion, out of working with other people, out of an awareness that we all bring a lot of different skills and backgrounds and proclivities to the table. But I think that whatever we do and whatever organizations we support, that we see the necessity to build coalitions. Not that we're going to get everything we want, and we do need to compromise in the legislative process, but recognizing the difference between compromise and capitulation. When we have a clear message, our principles are clear, out in Petaluma.
And you never compromise your principles.
Yeah, what the core principles are. And I think there's been a sort of a split that is a false choice between being principled and winning effectively. At our campaign rally in Petaluma, Sean Penn spoke alongside me a few weeks ago. And he used the phrase referring to what happened in Cairo, but also what we can do here, principle as strategy. If we are principled, if we articulate, if we build coalitions based on our humanistic progressive principles, then we have a capacity to build a strategy that's effective and get away from this idea, which I think is false, that either you choose to stick with your core values or you have a chance to win. We can do both.
How?
We can do it by, I think, in the electoral arena, moving beyond the idea that progressives simply need to build local institutions or national institutions. We got to take seriously the nuts and bolts of election campaigns. And I'm afraid quite often that's seen as too daunting. Well, you look around this conference and you see many dozens of organizations that were built with blood, sweat, and tears against the odds. And you go around the country and you see thousands of different groups that are creative, that are long-lasting, and yet many of the people engaged in that look at the election process and say, well, that's too tedious, too difficult. I think we've left the field and can no longer afford to leave the field to the corporate Democrats and then moving rightward from there.
Well, there was a certain leaving of the field, I think, in 2008, to the idea that, President Obama has been elected, we have majorities in the House and Senate, what's on TV?
Yeah.
Let's have a block party. There's that novel that I've been wanting to read for 2 years, the latest Grisham novel or whatever. And I think we really saw this in 2010, not only the outcome of Citizens United and the carpet bombing of America with corporate money, in ways that a lot of politicians, frankly, particularly on the left, had no idea was coming, and they should have. It's like not like a lot of us weren't screaming about it for years, but also people just decided it's cool. There's good people in charge. So now you're wearing the sticker "Healthcare, Not Warfare." This is pdamerica.org. Almost every day I'm pushing Progressive Democrats of America on the air. The inside outside game. Build a strong movement on the outside. Build a strong movement on the inside. This is what the Tea Party did. Basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a positive, very positive way, we need to link up, as the Tea Party has done, somewhat bogusly. But we have got to, as progressives, link up the grassroots organizing with what goes on Capitol Hill. There's essentially an invisible wall there where the bubble exists on the Capitol, under the Capitol Dome. And when we have members of Congress who are progressives, and there are so many of them, working more in tandem with people, organizing at the grassroots, not only will we change the public discourse much more for the better, but we'll also get better electoral results. As you say, the spectator sport tendency kicked in 2010. It never works. This is 24/7 eternal vigilance, or we don't get the job done.
Right. And in fact, the election day is not the end.
Right.
It's the beginning.
It's the beginning
of the next cycle. It's the beginning of the new activism. It's the beginning of holding those people accountable. It's the beginning of being the wind behind their back. Or I guess, you know, if they're really, really bad, the circular firing squad, as much as I hate the metaphor, but you know, it's the beginning.
We need each other every day.
There you go. Norman Solomon, SolomonForCongress.com, the website. Norman, I wish you the very best.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for being here with us today. And what's the name of your latest, your most recent book?
It's called Made Love, Got War.
Made Love, Got War. I remember that one. That was great. Okay, we'll be right back. Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference. Some of the conference partners, the Alliance for Educational Justice, the Bus Federation, the Carrying Across Generations, Center for Progressive Leadership, Change to Win, Choice U.S., that's just through the C's. We'll continue with the list as we go on. But right now, one of my favorites, and one of the groups, and get a little closer here so we're sure that you're in the shot here, Tim.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
One of my favorite groups that I've, and you know, confession's the wrong word. What is it when you say that you've got a...
Full disclosure.
Full disclosure. Thank you. Full disclosure. I'm on the advisory board of the organization, so but that's not why I promote it so much, because I think that Tim Carpenter and Progressive Democrats of America are doing some of the most important work in America, doing both the inside game and the outside game, working to build movement politics on the outside, and also working to take over the Democratic Party from within. But I shouldn't be saying that. You should. Tim Carpenter, welcome
great.
Back.
Thanks. And official sponsor of Rebuild the Dream. We made the cut. We're in.
You are one of the official sponsors of this conference.
Absolutely.
Okay, so tell us about the conference.
It's a big day for Progressive Democrats of America. We've been spending the last 6 years more on the outside, leafleting and trying to get what was initially Take Back America, which has merged this year with Van Jones, to adopt the inside-outside strategy. And you can feel something in the air, beginning with what's happening in Wall Street, what's going to be happening here in D.C. on Thursday and across the country with our outside piece. We need to bring the outside heat inside the Democratic Party. For 6 years, we've struggled here to do that. And this year, we're part of the conference. Both of PDAs are speaking at the conference in addition to working the halls.
You know, it took maybe a year, maybe not even that, for the Tea Party to move inside the Republican Party and basically take over a large chunk of it, take over enough of it that they could basically run the show, which they seem to be doing. What kind of successes has Progressive Democrats of America had, and in general, what kind of successes have progressives had in taking over or infiltrating or moving or whatever the appropriate phrase is? I don't want to sound, you know, I can just see me now on Glenn Beck's show, you know. Hartman says they're, you know, he's following the Marxist
manual. There's a soundbite here somewhere for
right,
Fox News.
Right, exactly.
Well, let's start with what we are. We're the insurgency inside the Democratic Party. We believe we need to move back the Democratic Party, as we're doing here today with Van Jones and Rebuild the Dream, back to our progressive roots, to what FDR promised us and Harry Truman. 6 years ago, we were born at the National Convention when John Kerry accepted the nomination. Many of us from Howard Dean and Dennis Kucinich's campaign, that we needed to work both inside and outside the party. What have we done in 6 years, Tom? What's the real benchmark? A lot of talking, but where's the action? Here this year alone, if you go visit California, Arizona, Massachusetts, grassroots Democrats are passing resolutions in support of single payer, holding the president accountable to get out of Afghanistan, taxing Wall Street. So the issues that unite us at the grassroots are beginning to resonate at the grassroots level inside the Democratic Party, and it's the work here that will push that up and to hold the president accountable. So what have we accomplished as PDA in 6 short years? 100 chapters around the country that get it, working both inside and outside, passing resolutions, and working in support in the streets, whether it be the nurses for single payer or the priests of justice community to get out of Afghanistan, bringing those movements together, healthcare, not warfare.
Healthcare, not warfare, which is what the button that I'm wearing on my jacket says.
Team colors.
There you go. Red, white, and blue. Team colors. So somebody's watching, somebody's listening right now, and they're going, you know, this Progressive Democrats of America, this sounds kind of cool. I don't have a local chapter. I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do.
The first most important thing is to know they're not alone. PDA is not an organization in the traditional sense. We don't have a membership card. We don't have a dues. Simply sign up and join. Become part of a community, as you've done, as part of our National Advisory Board. We have 60,000 activists that get it. We get on the phone all during the month on various issues, whether it be ending the occupations, whether it be ending global warming, whether it be economic justice. If you don't have a chapter in your community, you can simply get on the phone and be part of a virtual community of activists around the country. Or more importantly, build a chapter in your community. Call us up. You've done more wonders in helping us to have people find the website, pdamerica.org. Get signed up, and we'll plug you in. We have experienced in the last 3 months, I can say honestly, an incredible surge of folks that have come on board. Just your most recent visit to Wisconsin and the work that we did there, 8,000 activists in the halls there, 4 new chapters in Wisconsin alone. So it's very simple. Just visit pdamerica.org. Get plugged in, and know you're not alone. I think that's what this is about. Oftentimes we feel isolated and not connected, and PD America will connect you.
And it's a chance to come together. So if there, if PD America is not the kind of organization where you get a membership card, it's not like the CPUSA or something, you don't pay dues, what does a chapter do?
Chapters are, we're not a monolith by any means. Some chapters join with our brown bag vigils the third Wednesday of every month. Activists go to their members of Congress. It's one thing to click your mouse. It's another thing to get out in the streets.
Wait a minute, so every third Wednesday,
you give up your lunch hour. And you visit your member of Congress at noon.
And this is visit their local office, wherever you
Not everybody can travel to Washington. We can't all afford it, but you can go to your district office. That's one thing a chapter can do. Just prioritize 1 hour a month. Go to your member of Congress. Get in their face and let them know that this movement is alive and well. That's one thing you certainly can do. You can go to your local Democratic Party, as you said, the Tea Party. The party is there. We are the insurgency. Our activists are being elected all over the country at the grassroots level to bring our message. Go to your local meeting. And that's what today's about. Join those groups on the outside that are doing the work, whether it be United for Peace and Justice or Peace Action. Work with those organizations. Most importantly, the group I'd leave you with today is the National Nurses United. Who better than the nurses that are leading the fight to tax Wall Street, to bring that money, to bring about single payer? So what PDA is about is putting you in touch with those community activists that are making a real difference. If you call yourself a progressive Democrat or an insurgent, whatever it is, be part of the community that's about change. Challenge the Tea Party in your local community, in your neighborhoods, and help us take back the Democratic Party.
You know, what's so incredible about the nurses is that, you know, they're promoting the STET tax, the Securities Transaction Exchange tax that we used to have in this country until, I think, 64 when we did away with it. Very, very tiny tax. You know,
$300 billion.
A very tiny tax on every piece of stock exchange.
0.05%.
0.05%. Okay. One half of 1/100 of 1%. And yet it would produce, as you say, $300 billion. But not only that, Europe, the European Union, just voted to put it on their banksters. Did they not, or did I misread that in the Financial Times?
Yeah, and we were in Wall Street to remind folks of that. November 3rd, we're going to be at the Treasury Office to let Secretary Geithner know that we want this, to bring it on.
Right.
The President has framed the debate on deficit reduction. We don't need a deficit reduction. Bring the troops home. Take care of Medicare D, which allows us for global pharmaceuticals, so we can bring these drugs in through a program that will allow us to save $3.6 trillion. We're there. Now on the revenue side, as you just said, starting with that, and to roll back not just the Bush tax cuts, but go all the way back to the Reagan tax cuts, and we've got the revenue side. So the formula is there. What we're lacking is a president and a Congress to do that work.
Right. We basically, what we've seen in the United States is a counter-revolution to the New Deal and the Great Society. And that counter-revolution has been called the Reagan Revolution. But it was really a counter-revolution in as much as it was all about stopping something that had happened rather than moving something forward. It's very anti-Jeffersonian, in fact. It was,
you can nail that. Yes,
the Tories, you know, and not the Whigs, and so here we are moving forward, and with Progressive Democrats of America, how did PD America get started?
Many of us, as I said, were active in Howard Dean's campaign and Dennis Kucinich. Others of us go back all the way to Reverend Jackson in 1988. Others of us, to date ourselves, go back to Tom Hayden's campaign in 1976 when he ran for Senate. It's a core belief, Henry Wallace in 1948, working inside, outside the Democratic Party. There's a rich historic tradition here. Unfortunately, we don't read a lot about it. And we've captured that spirit and moving it forward now.
That's great. Did you ever read Henry Wallace's letter to the New York Times about what is a fascist?
I did my thesis and my master's to talk to the Nisei Progressives who were interned, who went to work for Henry Wallace. I think I've read just about everything. Yes,
that's
Henry
amazing.
Wallace, another American hero
that
we need to rediscover.
And if people don't know what we're talking about, I put a lot of it into two articles that I wrote for Common Dreams back about five or six years ago. If you Google Common Dreams, Tom Hartman, Henry Wallace, it'll pop up.
Gideon's Army, if you can read the history of the Wallace campaign, it's all there.
Yeah, yeah. But he said the real fascist that America has to worry about, and this was in the middle of World War II. He was the vice president, and he was FDR's vice president.
Came out against Truman, and the bombing was there from
the
beginning.
Right, right. He said the real fascists we have to worry about are not in Europe. They are the businessmen in America.
Here they are. And the fight continues.
What? What? The banksters? They're the real fascists? How dare the vice president say that? No wonder Roosevelt was saying they hate me and I welcome their hatred. Tim Carpenter, PDAmerica.org. Tim,
Tom,
thanks
thank
so much.
You.
Keep up the great work.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with Brian Seibel, the Director of Justice Programs at the Alliance for Justice. Stick around.
Yeah, running down a dream that never would come to me. Working on a mystery, going wherever it leads.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference. And Brian, did I pronounce it right, Seibel?
It's Seibel.
Seibel. My apologies. Brian Seibel is with us. He is the Director of Justice Programs for the Alliance for Justice. And are you a participant here in the conference?
Yes.
Okay, great. And a question of integrity, politics, ethics in the Supreme Court, new short documentary film. Tell us about this.
Well, every year AFJ does a film on a topic of interest, and this year we're doing our film on the lack of ethics at the U.S. Supreme Court. It's the only court in the United States that doesn't have an ethical code that binds them. So we find that rather outrageous. There have been a lot of allegations, a lot of improprieties going on. Justice Scalia and Thomas went to a Koch brothers event.
They've been to several, haven't they?
And they were headlined, and they were... You know, actually, the Koch brothers advertised the fact that the justices had been to their events to draw new participants, which is clearly in violation of the code of conduct. But
now my understanding is that the code of judicial ethics or code of judicial conduct that at the federal level, which is enforced as law, that federal judges, prosecutors, whatnot, can get kicked out, fired, maybe prosecuted. You would know better than me. And in fact, please let us know. That the Supreme Court has said that they are not, they cannot be held to that standard, and therefore you have Scalia going duck hunting with Dick Cheney, and then 2 weeks later giving him the decision that he wanted before the Supreme Court. Everybody remembers, poor old Harry getting shot in the face, but Cheney's duck hunting stories
right.
are
yeah.
legion. So is this true that the Supreme Court is held to a different standard? Or?
Well, they're not held to a standard. In terms of ethics, they're not held to a standard. So, for example...
To any standard?
No. I mean, like the Code of Conduct prohibits judges, federal judges, and actually state judges abide by each of the state codes that are out there. They can't do fundraisers, for example. They can't headline fundraisers, and yet the Supreme Court justices have done this. Justice Thomas, again... asked Harlan Crow to step in, one of his benefactors, to fund this historical site in Georgia where his mother had once worked. You know, these
Wait
are
a minute. A sitting Supreme Court of the Justice of the United States
yes.
asks a rich guy who...
Right, Harlan Crow, who's
he's one of the big developers, isn't this?
Yeah, exactly.
Trammell Crow?
Yes, his okay. son, yes. And gets flown around on Harlan Crow's jet and goes on his yacht and so forth. And Harlan Crow gave... $500,000 to Liberty Central when Justice Thomas's wife set it up, Jenny Thomas set this up. he gave $500,000. They raised $550,000 overall. So Harlan Crowe gave $500,000.
So they raised $50,000 in addition to Harlan Crowe's
yes,
money.
Exactly. Right.
And then Ginny draws a paycheck from this.
Correct. And, of course, that was all set up after Citizens United came down, which allowed them to spend corporate money on directly into elections. So,
amazing.
So there are clear ethical issues. There are issues with recusal. The problem is that justices decide for themselves when they want to recuse from cases or not. You gave the example of Justice Scalia choosing not to recuse himself in the case involving Vice President Cheney, which is all about, you know, what was going on behind the scenes with the Energy Task Force that the Vice President was setting up, and, you know, raised serious ethical issues. But Justice Scalia gets to decide for himself. So we've actually, earlier this year, we had 140 ethicists sign a letter to Congress calling for reforms, calling for the code of conduct to be applied, calling for recusal reform. There's a bill in Congress supported by Representative Murphy of Connecticut that has co-sponsors. There have been 20 Democratic House members who've sent a letter around recently calling for an investigation. Other things have happened, for example, is that Justice Thomas, for quite a number of years, didn't disclose his wife's income. He checked the none box, even though before he was a justice of the Supreme Court, he was a judge on the D.C. Circuit, and he would check the box. I mean, he didn't check the box there. He actually disclosed her income before, then suddenly stopped disclosing her income for a number of years until he was called on it, and then quickly, you know, said, oh, it was an inadvertent mistake, and amended all his forms. So there's a lot of ethical issues surrounding the court right now, and our film is going to go into these, touch on these things. It'll be coming out in a few weeks.
The website for the film, aquestionofintegrity.org, and the Alliance for Justice put
it's
this thing
AFJ.org,
together.
AFJ.org, yes.
AFJ.org. And Brian Siebel?
Yes.
Brian Siebel, the Director of Justice Programs. Beyond putting together this documentary that raises some of these questions about these various Supreme Court justices, what else does the Alliance for Justice do?
Well, we work on federal judicial nominations. We're seeking a progressive judiciary. We are very concerned that there are a ton of vacancies right now in the federal judiciary, over 100 vacancies, and these need to be filled. You know, President Obama has a window of time here in his first administration to try to fill these vacancies with progressive judges because it makes all the difference in the world. I mean, we can see, for example, health care is now likely to come up before the Supreme Court. A lot of issues that people fight so hard for in the legislatures then get challenged in court, and we need judges who are open-minded to hear these cases. So
last week I had a couple of conservatives on my TV show in the union, and I brought up the issue of Clarence Thomas and Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, coming before the Supreme Court, and their immediate response was, Elena Kagan better recuse herself. She
right. Yeah, there's a move afoot for that. No. No, certainly.
Why should she not?
Because she didn't have anything to do with the defense of the Affordable Care Act. She had nothing to do with it.
Very
and so she really, they'll accuse her of this, but I think.
Yeah, they did.
I think the answer is.
And I didn't know the answer, frankly.
I think the answer is she has no involvement.
She has no involvement. She had no involvement
correct,
in that.
Yeah. The other thing we work on is the corporate court. We're calling the Supreme Court really very much in the interests of business. They've been ruling a lot to support corporate interests over the interests of everyday Americans.
I think if they're going to take money from these corporations, they should at least wear the NASCAR patches on their
right,
ropes.
Right, exactly. Right.
Brian, thanks a lot for
thank
being with
thank you so much.
The website, aquestionofintegrity.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Coming up next, Leo Girard, the United Steelworkers Union. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C., and I am joined by one of my heroes, Leo Girard, the International President of the United Steelworkers, the website usw.org. And the United Steelworkers is urging the Senate to curb deliberate currency manipulations by China and others. And you guys are supporting the Occupied Wall Street movement. These are very, very strong statements for a union to make. You want to tell us about it?
Sure. First on the China currency, it's very clear that China's been manipulating its currency, making our exports, if we can get them into China, more expensive, making their imports into the U.S. less expensive. And we've been pushing with the Alliance for American Manufacturing, both the House and Senate, to finally take some action. We had been pushing Secretary Geithner to take action, and in fact, Brazil was talking about taking action against Chinese currency manipulation. So we suggested to Geithner that he tag team with Brazil, and both of them do it.
But Geithner is like totally opposed to this, isn't
he? He's dragging his feet.
Just like he's telling the Europeans, don't do a step tax, tax.
Yeah, and that's what we need.
And they're saying, and you did what?
Yeah. So I'm going to be up on the Hill tomorrow pushing them to do that and also pushing them not to pass these rotten trade deals. But I think what's happening in Europe with the transaction tax is what's needed in America. It would certainly stem speculation. Then when it comes back to Occupy Wall Street movement, people need to understand that these are the guys that literally destroyed millions of people's lives.
Not the occupiers, the Wall Street itself.
The
banksters.
Banksters and Ponzi scheme promoters.
Yeah.
And unlike some that wanted to use the term Ponzi scheme for Social Security, these guys used the Ponzi scheme to destroy lives from Wall Street. And so what people need to understand is that there's millions of people, students, seniors, who have lost everything they believed in. We've got students who are graduating with two master's degrees and college debts they can't pay because they can't find a job. And I think we have to support them. We have to hold Wall Street accountable if our government won't.
Yeah. No, it's... I see it in my own family and friends, and you know, it's people with advanced degrees who can't, and you know, America used to be a nation. My dad worked 40 years in a tool and die shop, you know, Lansing Tool and Die, where with one salary you could put your kids through school, you could raise a family, you could buy a new car every couple of years, you had a vacation every year, he had a pension till the day he died. That was the American dream until Ronald Reagan came along and said, no. The American dream is the lottery dream. It's that you may someday be an entrepreneur and become a billionaire. It's the Bill Gates dream. And the two things that we're not told is that, one, your odds of winning the lottery are higher than being Bill Gates, and two, that Bill Gates and the guy who started Facebook and all, they all very, I think almost without exception, they didn't come from the working classes.
Right.
They came from the upper middle class.
Yep.
You know, they had a lot of advantages. So what do we do to reclaim the American dream, the old-fashioned American dream, that anybody can make it in this country? And making it doesn't mean becoming a millionaire. Making it means having a decent life throughout the course of your life to the end of your life and being able to provide...
Well, I'm obviously very focused on rebuilding manufacturing.
Yes.
And having a dialogue about what's real wealth creation. You don't create real wealth by causing bubbles. You don't create real wealth by trading stock certificates. You don't cause real wealth by giving people's homes that they can't afford so you can dream of taking away later. You create real wealth by taking raw material, ingenuity, creativity, energy, and making something of value, taking those things of value and adding them to something else. And first thing you know, you got a car or an airplane. Then we also got to talk about the reality is that we can compete with anybody in the world given a level playing field. To ask a steel worker from Baltimore to compete against a Chinese worker who's making $2 a day, let alone $2 an hour, with a company that's getting free land, getting cheap money, getting innovation that's given to them, and undervalues their currency, is asking us to fail.
And no pollution controls.
And no what?
Pollution controls.
Absolutely none.
Yeah.
You can make a ton of steel in Pittsburgh with one-third the amount of carbon emissions you do in China. So I keep telling people, it's not called Chicago warming or L.A. warming. It's called global warming.
Yeah.
So we've been transferring our jobs. To me, that's one of the things we've got to do. The other thing is we've got to fix health care.
Mm.
I mean, we've now got 55 million people with no health care or inadequate health care because health care is tied to a job. So you lose your job, you lose your health care. We've got to have Wall Street quit stealing our pension money. I mean, I think of our people and a number of places where I've negotiated contracts where you went in to negotiate with a pension plan that was fully funded. You come back 3 years later and all of a sudden it's underfunded. Why? Not because that we improved pensions, because Wall Street blew the value. And they've done that how many times? Not just the last Wall Street collapse, the time before that when we were told that we didn't have to worry about the tech bubble, the time before that when we were told, the time before that when we had the accounting scandal, the time before that when we had the savings and loan scandal. How many scandals we let these guys force down our throat before we say enough is enough? And that's the reason we're going to support the Occupy Wall Street crowd.
That's great. You know, the thing, you mentioned that, the savings and loan scandal. I didn't know Bill Seidman personally, but I talked with him. He's the guy that Reagan brought in to deal with it.
Right.
And what they did was they nationalized the savings and loans. They fired all the management.
Yeah.
All the stockholders got screwed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, they took them over, and they put government, literally occupied them with government bookkeepers, government employees,
yeah,
and built them back up to the point where they were, and re-regulated them, 100%
re-regulated
them. And this was done by Ronald Reagan's administration.
Yeah. And 1,600 of them went to jail.
Yes, and 1,600 went to jail.
So far, the only thing we've seen in jail is one guy who was obviously a crook on his own.
You're talking about Bernie Madoff.
Bernie Madoff.
Yeah.
He's the only guy that, he's the only public perp.
And the other one was the guy who worked for UBS in Switzerland, who was
a
whistleblower.
Low-level whistleblower they whacked.
Yeah, and he should have been a hero, actually.
Yeah.
Because he outed the fact that they were sitting on 16,000 American millionaires who were hiding their tax money.
Yeah, so they whacked him.
Yeah, so he's in prison. I mean, it's absolutely nuts. Why the Republican Party, why the Democratic Party can't do what the Reagan administration did.
Ronald Reagan wouldn't qualify to get on the Republican ballot today.
And not on, in some states, he wouldn't get on the Democratic ballot.
And Richard Nixon would be a progressive Democrat today.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's how badly things have gotten.
Other than his mental illness, his paranoia.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm solidly with you. And it's one of the, you know, my dad was a Republican until the day he died, but he was an Eisenhower Republican.
Yeah.
And you know, it was... He must just
That Republican Party doesn't exist. In fact, I saw a bumper sticker yesterday on my way to the conference here that said, Republicans want millions of people without work so they can get one man's job.
It's true.
That's what's going on.
It's true. And it's 2009 was the last time that the Republicans allowed any kind of stimulus to this economy, and they had watered that down radically and filled it with tax breaks and goodies for their buddies. And now they are just going to hold the line. So, Leo Gerard, between now and November 2012, assuming that the Republicans continue to do the Mitch McConnell make Obama a one-term president plan of making the economy as bad as possible and taking down the world economy with it, or sliding down the hill with the world economy, you know, whatever it may be, doing nothing about it, how do we awaken Americans to this fact?
I think by the kinds of things that are going on Occupy Wall Street, I think by the kind of conferences that are going on here, bringing people of shared values, whether we're progressives or what we call ourselves, people of shared values that want to rebuild the American dream, going back and igniting the grassroots on that there doesn't have to be this way, mobilizing the labor movement, the environmental movement, the anti-poverty movement, the social justice movement. I mean, there's more of us than there are of them.
Yeah.
And we've got to quit whining and complaining and sending letters. I gave a speech recently and said Mahatma Gandhi didn't write letters to the Queen of England saying that you're not being fair. and he marched across India in barefoot. Nelson Mandela didn't whine. He fought for 30 years and sacrificed his life. Martin Luther King marched. Writing letters and whining is not going to change anything. We need to march. We need to mobilize. We need to educate. We need to agitate. We need to take to the streets. So that has to be. The economy doesn't have to be this way. This is still a very rich country. It's just that the poverty is going to the working class. Wealth is going to the upper class. We have to change that. We have to reverse it.
And in the minute we have left, specific steps that the United Steelworkers or that you, Leah Gerard, are promoting?
Well, in our case, we're going to strengthen our education, mobilize our membership. We're going to train people to run campaigns, not just political campaigns, but grassroots campaigns. And we're going to try to get to a level of 10 to 12 to 15,000 volunteers, if we can, who will be doing things in the year that's upcoming, 2012, not just for the election, but for the economy, for our jobs, and for a fight back. Our theme at our convention was Stand Up, Fight Back.
Yeah, and that's very well said. That's what people need to be doing, and I find it. Have any other unions joined you in supporting the Occupy Wall Street movement?
Yeah, and in fact, Rich Crumka from the AFL-CIO spoke out, and Randy Weingarten from the teachers' union spoke
out. That's great.
Out.
Who represents the police officers in New York?
In fact, I'm not sure.
Teamsters?
No, the police officers in New York have their own organization. Just before I came down to do your show, I saw an email from the Occupy Wall Street that said they had an undocumented report that 100 police officers today refused to go and arrest these kids and
yes.
to work against them.
Yeah, I've seen that too. We'll see how it works out. Leo Girard, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, and keep up the great work.
You too, sir. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more. Your calls, your thoughts, my thoughts, up with the news and all sorts of stuff here from the Take Back the American Dream Conference in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, who do you love? Oh, who do you love?
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference in Washington, D.C., where we are broadcasting from the Free Speech TV E-Studio. And Jay Goodman Tamboli is in our studio in Washington, D.C.
I'm holding it down at your desk, Tom. It's very comfortable.
How cool is that? And Jay, of course, an attorney, a reporter, a credentialed White House and congressional and Supreme Court reporter. And what better guy than to tell us what's going on with the Supreme Court and also what other news may be going on today. Jay Goodman Tamboli, take it away.
Well, Tom, today was the Supreme Court's first day of the, as they term it, the October term 2011. And Chief Justice Roberts opened the term today by noting that it is the 25th anniversary of Justice Scalia joining the court. And he said, with Scalia on the court now, it has never been the same, or things have never been the same. So
he's right.
I got a good chuckle from the courtroom. The two cases today, starting out, were one involving Medicaid payments. The state of California a couple of years ago decided to cut Medicaid payments to doctors, and they didn't go through the normal process where they would apply to the Department of Health and Human Services to get approval for those cuts. They just kind of did it, and you know they were under budget constraints, and we can talk about that. It's a separate issue, but what happened was a group of doctors and doctors' groups sued, saying that they couldn't just cut these rates, that they had to go through the procedure, and that the new rates were unfair. The problem is that the federal Medicaid law doesn't provide for any kind of lawsuits by individual providers. It basically sets up a system where the federal government and the states handle it all. A state can choose whether to participate or not. And if they want to draw, you know, lower rates, they have to go through this whole process of getting approval. So, you know, basically you had these doctors in the court today trying to convince the justices that, you know, there was some reason they should be allowed to stand up and sue on this.
Right.
I think the justices generally were not very receptive to that argument. A lot of that came from the fact that Congress at one point had a way for individual doctors and groups to sue over low rates, and there were just too many lawsuits, so they said, okay, you know, HHS handles this.
Is this a variation on a repeat of what happened in the Walmart case?
It's in the sense that there's a question of whether courts can handle this many lawsuits.
Class yes. actions?
It's not a class action. It was individual, you know, doctors and groups suing. So it wasn't a class action issue.
Right.
But
so
I
it's
think
a standing issue.
It's a standing issue, exactly, because the law doesn't provide for this kind of lawsuit. And I think there were some hints by various justices that if they were to come back to court and say, we just want the new rates to be stopped and not ask for back pay, not ask for damages, that might be better because that would be a suit in equity. They're just asking for an injunction rather than asking for damages. They might be a little bit more receptive to that. But I think that the suit over damages is probably going to fail. The second case today deals with the sex offender registration databases. It's kind of a weird procedural standing issue because what happened was when Congress passed SORNA, the sex offender registration law, it was kind of a little ambiguous as to whether it covered people who had been convicted and then released before the law was even passed. The Attorney General basically issued a rule and said, okay, I'm going to say, the Attorney General said he thought the law covered that it was retroactive, but he said just in case he's going to issue a rule saying that. He issued a an interim rule immediately and then went through the normal APA, Administrative Procedures Act process, and that rule came out about a year and a half later. So the question in this case is people convicted of not registering during that year and a half period, for them, did the law as it was written say they had to register, or is there room for a challenge to the way the Attorney General went about it? So it's a little bit technical, and I think the justices were, you know, just kind of a little bored with the case because it's not a clear, you know, it doesn't affect a ton of people.
Well, isn't this, I mean, the way you're describing it, it sounds like this is the, what's the Latin, or maybe it's English for laws that
Ex post facto.
Ex post facto, thank you. Laws that make things before the law was put into place criminal. You can't do that, according to the Constitution.
Yeah, and, you know, unfortunately, the ship has kind of sailed on that argument for sex offenders. And I think that the way the court got out of that is they said that being required to register and, you know, restrictions on where you live and things like that, that those aren't a punishment. And therefore, they don't fall under the, you know, ex post facto means you can't make something against the law and punish someone afterward, and you can't increase the punishment later also.
Okay.
But they said that's not an issue here.
But I thought, you know, I thought the Constitution said Congress shall pass no ex post facto laws. You know, just, you know, basically, period. You can't have laws that reach into the past.
Well,
has the Supreme Court narrowed that to only be laws that have to do with punishment, or was it originally in that context?
Well, the way the Supreme Court has interpreted it, and this I don't remember how old this decision was, but this is a decision from the early days of the Supreme Court, is that ex post facto means, A, you can't make something illegal after the person has done it, and B, you can't increase the punishment after the person has done it, or after the person's been convicted, and that, you know, something like this where you're requiring somebody to register, that's kind of a new crime, that it's not a punishment for something you've already done, but it's saying this is something new. People who have this status, that is a sex offender, have to register.
Right.
That's a new issue. If they fail to register, that's a new crime.
Right.
So that's the way they've gotten out of that. Briefly, this, as I said, today's the first day of the new term. A lot of big cases coming up this term of interest to talk radio people, of course. There is a First Amendment challenge to the FCC's power to regulate indecency. That's curse words, nudity, things like that on broadcast television.
Right.
And on radio.
This is following the Janet Jackson thing.
Right. So there was an issue there with did they enact the rule the right way. Now it's really a First Amendment challenge, so that's going to get good. There's also a challenge to eyewitness testimony, which could be really interesting. As to how judges evaluate eyewitness testimony, and you know, a bunch of other stuff coming up, including, I don't know how much time you got left, but a quick death penalty case. A guy had pro bono lawyers, the mailroom messed up and lost his filing, and he was sentenced to death. He claims, you know, that's not fair, and I think he's got a good argument there.
Yes. He was sentenced to death because they lost his paperwork?
They missed filing deadlines, and he missed his appeal.
Wow. And the Supreme Court has agreed to take this case.
They will be taking that later this year. I don't know when that's scheduled for, but
that should be very interesting. Okay, Jay Goodman-Tamboli with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Jay, thanks a lot for the report today.
Thank you.
Great to hear from you. Up next from here, live from here at the Take Back the American Dream Conference, Van Jones will be with us. Stick around.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference. With me, one of my heroes, one of the finest activists in America, the former Green Jobs czar over at the White House. I almost said, best friend of Glenn Beck, but I won't.
Someday.
Yeah.
Someday.
The co-founder and president of RebuildTheDream.com. Get over there, check it out. Van Jones is with us, back on the program.
I'm glad to be here. It's such an honor. Now I want to say something now. You were the first national media figure to embrace this cause of taking all our economic fights and putting them under a common banner that we're defending the American dream, not having the veterans over here by themselves and having the foreclosed victims over there and the unions over there, but put everybody together and have a common banner that we're all defending the American dream. That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, because we were able to get a little bit of attention from this program, and I don't know if your viewership and listenership understands how strong they are. Every time we would come on your show, our numbers would go up, our membership would go up, people would get more active, more involved, and now here we are with almost 2,000 people here in D.C. Stuff's going on Wall Street, so inspiring. And here inside of the four walls of this conference center, we just had about 30 national leaders stand up and commit that we're going to function now as one movement going together. So it's a really extraordinary opportunity.
So that was the keynote speech you gave this morning.
Yeah. I mean,
tell us about it.
Well, you know, we have reached out to about 70 organizations. And we said, how could we be so full of hope just a little while ago and now be so heartbroken? But skip the fight in the middle. Mm. It's one thing if you...
What happened to that? What happened
exactly
to that?
Like, it's one thing if we had put millions of people in the street and gotten beat. It'd be one thing if we were doing sit-ins everywhere and gotten beat. It'd be one thing if we were doing teach-ins all across the country and gotten beat. But we went from hope to heartbreak, from hopey to mopey, and skipped the fight.
And well, so, I think a lot of Americans said, hey, we elected a Democratic president, House, Senate, what's on TV?
Exactly. And so I think now we've learned that lesson. And you see what's happening with these young people and other struggling folks on Wall Street. And it used to be you say Wall Street, everybody would frown. Now you say Wall Street, everybody smiles. That shows you the power of the people.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And I'm curious, you're not – we're talking with Van Jones, and you really need to check out this website. And if you're not a part of it, become a part of it. RebuildTheDream.com is the website. I do have that right, Tom.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
.com. That's right.
And you know, sign up and participate. This is an extraordinary opportunity. And you know, enough of us get on there right now. You can, well, no. Yeah. Regularly, I do this, and we crash people's websites.
Well, you know, we'd be happy to have.
Honor,
you know, one of the great things about what we're doing, you know, we built RebuildTheDream.com as a backup center, a support center, for this growing movement.
Yeah.
And so I'm the president of RebuildTheDream.com, but as I say, the American Dream movement, not owned by anybody, and movements don't have presidents, they have principals.
Yes.
And the people. And so we built this thing, it's a support center, we hope people will go and support. We've had 600,000 people go to that website, sign up to be supportive in every congressional district we are now. We just launched in late June. There is such a hunger out there. When the Tea Party launched, it had 800 House meetings across America. People thought it was amazing. We had 1,597, three shy of double. That when we just to start with no Fox TV, no Koch Brothers money, just good programs like yours and grassroots Netroots, and we started out twice the size of the Tea Party. The media didn't say a word about it. The Tea Party got 50,000 people involved to crowdsource their jobs agenda. We didn't have 50,000 people when we did it. We had 131,203, almost triple the number of the Tea Party participants, again, with no media hype, just hard work of organizing.
Yeah.
And so now, like I said, we have 600,000 people. They've all signed on to get work done. We want to double that number. We're talking about running American Dream candidates to begin to not just take back the House, but to begin to take back the state houses and the dog catcher, whatever else. People who believe in the middle class, people who believe in the institutions that made our country great, people who don't think our grandparents were stupid when they created Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security. We have not been able to find each other since the 2008 campaign. We've been scattered to the winds. And so now we are reforming and coming back together, the same coalition, the same forces that beat Karl Rove and beat the McCain team and put America on a positive track. Those are the forces that are now coming back together under this banner of the American Dream Movement, and we are not going to be stopped. And this time, it won't be about a politician or a party. It's going to be about principles and the people.
You know, in 1798, Thomas Jefferson wrote a famous letter, famous long after he was dead, actually, because it was to be kept in confidence, about his disappointment with the Adams administration that he was the vice president of.
Mm.
And the letter had this phrase, the time of the witches will pass over and their spells will be broken, which is the famous phrase from it. But at the very end he said, for this is a battle where principles are the stake. Mm. In other words, it wasn't about his presidency, it was about principles. And you're the first person in all the, I wrote about that in What Would Jefferson Do 15 years ago, a book I wrote about Thomas Jefferson's. And
And I'm just, yes, you got me. Okay, so let me ask you, Van Jones.
Sure.
There's the inside game and there's the outside game.
That's right.
And there are some among us, and I hear them all the time calling up saying, forget the inside game, forget about politics. Mm-hmm. They're sellouts, blah, 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 quack, 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 quack. And then there's just do the outside game, mm-hmm. Just be in the streets. And then there are those who say, you know, those in the streets, they're not going to do anything unless we take over politics. And really, we need to be completely on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
I personally think we need to be doing both. I'm mm-hmm. curious your take on this and how rebuildthedream.com
yeah.
builds into this inside-outside game.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Most people are pretty smart. And people like to argue with each other online and kind of say certain things, but most people are pretty smart. We know now that without a mass movement, we're going backwards, not forwards. We know that. And we know that the White House is not going to build a mass movement. It's not their job. I hear they have a country to run. So so we're going to have to build a mass movement. And in that, we are in good keeping with our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents who built a movement. They didn't wait for LBJ to build the Civil Rights Movement. They built the movement that then let LBJ sign those bills. FDR didn't lead the labor struggles that led to the New Deal. The labor movement got out there and fought. Even Abraham Lincoln didn't lead the abolitionists. That was Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman.
In fact, he was opposed to the abolitionists.
Exactly, he was opposed to the abolitionists.
Still after his presidency.
Yeah, exactly. And so what we know is that we're smart enough to know in America, and our history confirms this, that you have to build mass movements. You have to be involved. You have to take it to the streets. You have to do the sit-ins. You have to speak out for truth. You have to bring the artist in. You have to touch the conscience of the nation. But we also know that if we hand over the keys to power to people who will not be touched by our movements no matter what, who would rather shoot us down in the streets than actually listen to the voice of the people, that's a mistake. And so what we have to be willing to do is to do both. And we have to be, our children's lives are at stake here. And when something happens to your child, you don't say, well, what's the one thing I'm going to do? You say, I'm going to do everything I can to save my child. We have to do everything we can to save this country.
Yeah, so well said. Our children, our grandchildren, and the seven generations hence.
Exactly.
To quote the Iroquois Confederacy.
And this is our turn. I mean, if you see what's happening now with those young people and struggling folks on Wall Street, and you see what's happening in this conference, the spirit in this conference, the enthusiasm. People were depressed just 6 weeks ago, depressed, morose. You couldn't get anybody. People are breaking through the depression now, and they are standing up. And we are going to defend the American dream. We're going to take it back from these dream killers. We're going to get back on the road we were on in 2008. But this time, people-powered, people-owned. It will never be taken from us again. This is our movement, and we are going to take this country to the next century.
Yeah, and it has been. You know, this is the fulfillment of the ideals of the founding of this country.
Exactly.
You know, the idea of a, but.
Yeah, liberty and justice for all. How
there
about
you
that?
Go. Yeah, yeah.
How about that?
Van Jones.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so
appreciate
much.
Appreciate you.
Great
thank
work you are
thank
doing.
Thank you for believing
it
in us.
It is an honor to have you on. And we'll be back with more in just a minute. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference in Washington, D.C.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, yeah, they're selling propaganda and pretending it's fact. Must be a Fox News with those right-wing views. Yeah, they're trying to convince you the rich should get richer.
That's their plot. It's definitely their plan. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and broadcasting live coast to coast. And, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky. Hey, welcome. Have a seat. One of my favorite people, favorite members of Congress and favorite people in general.
Thank you.
So
and
great to have you here
compliment.
With us.
I feel
it,
the same about you.
It is spectacular what you have done, what you are doing, and I so often refer to you on the air as people call me. It's not good politics. Have you heard about Jan Schakowsky? So what's up? You're here at the Take Back the American Dream Conference. I think
right.
It's interesting that they've incorporated the language of Van Jones' organization into what used to be the Take Back America Conference, put on by ourfuture.org. And what's your sense of what's going on here, and what are you doing with what's going on here?
What's important here is that if we can mobilize the American people about what they already believe, which is we need more jobs,
mm-hmm.
we need to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and we need to have a fair tax system so that everybody pays their fair share,
right.
that is a way out of this economic mess that we're in. The beauty is that we have the high ground. Most Americans agree with us. What you're going to hear at this conference are things that are just at the core values of all Americans. And the Republicans right now are trying to steal that American dream away.
Well, in a way, what I say is that they recalibrated it. The Ronald Reagan came along. The American dream used to be the middle-class dream. And he said, no, that's not the American dream. The American dream is the get-rich dream. It's the lottery dream. And you, too, can become Bill Gates. You, too, can win the lottery. And we need to take...
You know, and I grew up in a different America. I've been thinking a
Me
lot
too.
About that, yeah. where my dad was a furniture salesman. But we lived a middle-class life.
Yeah.
You could be a steel worker.
My dad
and,
worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years.
There you
raised
go.
Raised four boys.
Union job,
Union
I
Union job, yeah.
Healthcare, right?
Yeah, till the day he died. Had a pension, had healthcare. Bought a new car every 3 years, took a two-week vacation every year.
Exactly. And that was the normal.
Yeah.
This wasn't an extraordinary thing. That was what the expectation was in the United States of America. And what I don't want to see is people becoming accustomed to a new normal where they have to struggle to have a job, two, three jobs in a family. Maybe one will have health care benefits,
yeah.
Where even Social Security they want to privatize and go to the whims of the of Wall Street. You know, we have to bring back the idea that it is a robust middle class that makes our country great. We should invoke patriotism here, that it's perfectly un-American to say that, you know, it's dog-eat-dog, it's Darwinism, and if you make it, then you deserve to get all the benefits.
Yeah. Well, and the middle class is something that frankly terrifies the right. From Russell Kirk in 1951 when he wrote The Conservative Mind, which became the Bible. It was the book that galvanized Barry Goldwater. And he was quoting Edmund Burke. And his entire first chapter was devoted to Sir Edmund Burke, the famous British conservative at the time of the American Revolution, who said, it does me no harm if a man is allowed to engage in a profession as servile as that of tallow maker, candle maker, or hairdresser. However, it does society considerable violence if such a person is allowed to participate in governance by voting.
Incredible.
I mean, want a middle class.
They right? don't, but Ronald Reagan, I just saw a quote today about how rich people ought to pay more. There's a video, apparently, that's going around that I want to look at.
Is this pre-48 or post-48?
This is Ronald Reagan as President of the United States talking.
My.
And even the taxes that I proposed for millionaires and billionaires, the tax
yeah.
rates, are lower than those under Ronald Reagan. I mean, there's just such a turnaround right now. And these conversations, if you watch the Republican debate, that would not be taken seriously, that this wouldn't be part of normal discourse in this country. And these are people that aspire to be president, getting
yes.
rid of the environmental protection and every other kind of protections for consumers,
right.
get government out of the way so that we can have what? You know, the jungle again, where
right.
meat was dirty and air is dirty.
We just had 17 people die of listeria poisoning, and we have 1 in 240, I think the number is now, children being born with autism, which seems to have an environmental component, probably mercury.
And we're just going to be considering this week in the Congress a bill about cement factories and et cetera, releasing more mercury. And their rationale is that jobs. And the
right.
obstacle,
they can
do it the greatest that way. Obstacle to jobs now is this kind of consumer protection. It is so unforward-looking.
Yeah.
There are great jobs to be had in the future, and we can't give up on a robust middle class if we want to compete in the world.
Yeah. Well, they told us that about seatbelts. You know, when Ralph Nader wrote on Safe at Any Speed in 1974, and there was this, you know, move to get seatbelts, and the
right.
car company said, oh, we'll have to lay off people. Well, in fact, what it did is it made jobs. You had people had to design them, factories had to make them, people had to install them, added, you know, $20 to the cost of a car, saved millions of lives. Regulations actually create
the
jobs.
The Clean Air Act created lots of new jobs.
Yeah. I mean, I keep getting conservatives on and saying, you know, show me one regulation that costs jobs net-net when all was said and done. I don't know. Maybe there's some obscure one someplace, but it's... I just find it amazing. So Jan Schakowsky, representing so ably the 9th District of Illinois.
Thank you.
I want to mention that. Schakowsky.house.gov, Schakowsky.house.gov is your website. And I'm assuming we can keep up with what you're doing because your tax rebuild the middle class, the Progressive Caucus plan, all that stuff is there?
It's all there.
Okay, it's Schakowsky.house.gov. Keep up the great work, please.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate you.
It is such an honor to have you on this program. We'll keep fighting. Yeah, there you go. You're just great.
Thank you.
Congresswoman, thank you so much for being with us. We'll be back. It's the Tom Hartman Program live from Washington, D.C., the Take Back America Conference. Well, as I said, here in Washington, D.C. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So how do we take back America? More about that in just a minute. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference in Washington, D.C., a whole group of great organizations participating in this. And sitting next to me, my old friend and compatriot, Medea Benjamin. What's up? Code Pink, first of all. The website is?
CodePink.org.
CodePink.org, yeah. Very simply. And you've been participating in the... Actually, Jacob was telling me he saw you in McPherson Square over the weekend in these Occupy Wall Street. Now it's Occupy fill in the blank.
Occupy everywhere.
Yeah.
So
your notion of what is this? What's going on from your point of view?
Well, I went down to New York when this was starting and was so excited to see it's not just us old people, it's young people, and to see the real grassroots energy. And been going back, was back there last weekend, and we had been planning already an Occupy DC that was going to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the Afghan War. We had planned it for October 6th, and now to see it in this context of occupations springing up all over the country, you know, I don't know about you, Tom, I'm sure listening to your show, we all kept saying, where's the protest? Where's the protest? And we had done ones on Wall Street in the last couple of years, called people to come down, a hundred people would show up, and that would be the end of it. So the brilliance of this is you don't go home. And yeah. I think giving people a space, you know, I was in Tahrir Square, spent 2 weeks during the Egyptian Revolution, lived in that square there. I was in Madison. It's the same kind of energy, and you see this thirst that people have for community. And the idea that we can come together, find our collective voice, start organizing a mini city right there with here's the people doing the cleanup and the people doing the communications and the people doing the medical and even got their own bookstores. And these kind of things are getting replicated now all over the world, and it satisfies this desire that we have, young, old, no matter what, to have more of a collective space. And I think it's fabulous.
You know, I was watching Fox News over the weekend, because when we turned the TV on to see what was going on, CNN was not doing news, and MSNBC was not doing news, and none of the local TV stations or network stations were doing news, so what the hell, let's see what Fox has to say. And they were actually covering what was going on in New York, and their coverage was, and I'm old enough to have flashbacks from this, their coverage was this guy saying, yeah, I went down there, and, well, what's it like, George? Oh, it smells like urine and pot. It's a bunch of hippies. And it was just exactly the way that Nixon talked about the anti-war movement. I mean, just exactly.
No, and they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
It's not funded by Koch brothers. It's got nobody. I mean, what's beautiful is to see the outpouring of support. If people can't go there, not only the sending of pizzas, but, you know, there's a list online of these are the things we need. And they're now rolling up with, you know, UPS and the Postal Service, because now it's its own location coming in with these packages and things. Fox doesn't know what to do with real grassroots.
Yeah, no, they don't. Because and in fact, I would say that what has happened with the Tea Party is that it was built from the top down, but the top was invisible. They always tried to pretend that they weren't there. But it was really Dick Armey and the Koch brothers and these guys and all these giant PR firms in L.A. and New York. And I knew it in the media because I got all our stuff, and we talked about it a lot on it. But the grassroots people who showed up were well-intentioned. They were they want a revolution.
Yeah.
And I mean
yeah.
that in the not in the gun sense, but in the revolution of 1800, the revolution of the New Deal, the revolution of the Great Society. They wanted that. They just didn't. They were low-information voters. They were clueless. And now, you know, the Tea Party throws an event and six people show up because the grassroots has vanished and they're left with a bunch of politicians. They don't know what to do with it. I think that this bottom-up thing that is happening here is going to start bringing politicians in. Charlie Rangel showed up. I think it's the beginning.
Well, it was really interesting. When I first got to New York, no union would come by there. None of the what you would call the nonprofit organizations would come by there. I mean, they didn't like it. They said, no, this is hippie stuff. You could see ladies without their tops on. I mean, this is, you know, we don't want to be associated with this. And as it kept building, but you know what did it was the police brutality. If the police hadn't pepper sprayed those girls, this thing might have fizzled out. But they got it. That image on the front page of the main New York City newspapers just blew the whole thing up. And people were like, oh, okay, we got to go there and support. They can't just pepper spray these young girls in the for standing on the sidewalk. That gave it momentum. These mass arrests at the Brooklyn Bridge gave it momentum. The police have been our best friends in the sense of, you know, giving something.
You almost wonder if Tony Baloney had any idea what, you know, what he was doing. It's and that you know plays into that theme of revolution, counter-revolution, I think, in a very real way.
Well, but, you know, also the dynamic, when I first got to Wall Street, they had this info desk, and this was before the pepper spraying incident happened. And they had a young man sitting at the desk, and I said, so, you know, what's this about? I just wanted to hear what his rap was. And he started talking about it. Something about the police came up because they were right around there. And he said from the very beginning, the police are part of the 99%. The police are not our enemies. The police are fighting for their pensions, for their pay. And I think, you know, that was a conscious decision by the group to try to bring the police in. Now, it's gotten a little dicey when police start pepper spraying you and bring around those silly orange nets and just gather people up and arrest them. But there's a lot of intentional thought going into how do we create an atmosphere where even somebody from Wall Street can walk in here and be curious enough to open up discussions, and maybe we can start winning them over.
Here's the danger, and I'm curious your thoughts on how we avoid this. I was in SDS, as you know, in the 60s, and the person I knew was pardoned by Bill Clinton, Linda Evans. The Weather Underground, much of it grew out of that Michigan SDS, and there were always people in our group who were calling for violence, and some of them went off and became violent. There have been times in America when we've had really extraordinary and very positive movements that have basically shot themselves in the foot by not following Gandhi's principle that one small act of reactive violence is the same as a drop of arsenic in a glass of water. You know, that is, how do we stop this from turning into a caricature of itself? How do we keep it pure and strong?
Well, it's so funny. I don't really see that happening because I see a lot of emphasis on nonviolence. There's nonviolence trainings going on all the time. I was on their live stream, and somebody wrote in a question, what do you think of vandalism? And the guy who was behind the screen who was saying, okay, your next question is, what do you think of vandalism? And he looked at me, and he said, make sure you say no. Make sure you say no. And I mean, I was going to say no anyway, but it was.
But look at in '98 in Seattle, the WTO was there, and that could have been this moment, except for those guys dressed in black who showed up and started throwing Molotov cocktails through windows.
I don't think that this crowd will let that happen. I think they'll stop people. I think there might be individuals who try. There might be provocateurs.
And the same thing happened in the UK.
Yeah, I actually see it more concerned, is it going to get co-opted by the Democratic Party? are too many people from that have too close ties to the unions, to the Democrats, going to see, okay, now this is a movement, let's get involved in it. That's more my concern than the violence. Like, we're doing the one in D.C. that starts on Thursday. The nonviolence trainings have already started. Nonviolent monitors will be there. We're going to do our best to keep that from happening. And I think that's lessons learned along the way. And we also want a safe environment. That's why we don't want the police attack. We don't want arrests, really. I mean, that is not the purpose of any of this. I want movements where parents can come with their kids, they can bring their strollers, they can bring their grandparents, where it's people who might have immigration issues are going to feel safe coming. So it's in our interest to keep it a safe space, to make sure that it's, it doesn't become okay to do vandalism or violence. And I think people understand that, Tom. The other thing that's important, I think, is to keep it a space where people can come and bring their ideas, because we don't have that now. And it was tough organizing for this D.C. one. We wanted to have enough going on that would bring people in and keep them busy in the beginning, but open enough that they could bring their ideas.
Well, now so, it's going to become basically synthesized with the spread of the Occupy Wall Street movement, is it not?
Well, you know what our first day was already planned, the Chamber of Commerce and K Street. And so it's going to be a beautiful synergy between from Wall Street to K Street, and we hope that your listeners and your viewers
and the website
will go
for
online
that movement is
October 2011.
Okay, October 2011.
Right, the year.
.org. .org,
yeah.
Thank you. And, of course, OccupyWallStreet.org.
And CodePink.org. We'll have lots of information up there as well.
Yeah, and CodePink.org. And, in fact, I'd say in particular CodePink.org, because I think that if we don't support the people who've been around for a while, doing the hard work on the ground, showing up, putting their bodies and lives at risk, as you personally have done so many times, and that, you know, events come and go, movements come and go. I think this is the beginning of something big. Actually, I think we're halfway into it. I think it's been going on for about 10 years, maybe 15. But the on-the-ground organizations like Code Pink really need to be supported as well.
Well, thank you, and we need lots of young people, so join us.
Yeah, yeah, that's the thing. We need to transform. This is really a generational transformation. I mean, this is, and it seems to come around about every other generation, about every 30 years.
Well, you
or
say
so.
We're the 30s and 40s people. You know, it's got the 50s and
You're
up, and now we're going
to
have young
people.
To the
Tom Hartman program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back. I'm sorry, I didn't even hear that music. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here live from Washington, D.C. Medea Benjamin, CodePink.org.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
And some of the groups here, the Center for Progressive Leadership, Change to Win, Choice USA, Community Justice Network for Youth, Democracy Corps, Democratic Gain, the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy, the Energy Action Coalition, the Engage Network, the Fair Share Alliance, Green for All, Highlander Research and Education, Hip Hop Congress, Progressive Media Row Partners, The Tom Hartman Show, War is a Crime, WBAI, Ring of Fire Radio, The Nation, Nicole Sandler's Show, Op-Ed News, Majority Report, Daily Kos, David Pakman Show, Defending Wisconsin, the Democratic Left. This is just a touch of them. AFL-CIO blog, Alternet, the Center for Media and Democracy, PR Watch. Ourfuture.org is where you can learn all about what's going on at this conference. Marie, you're going to have to pronounce the name of that city, Marie, for me in Colorado.
El Jamel.
Okay, and what's up?
Well, first of all, I wish I could be there, so thank you very much for broadcasting this all day. I wanted to come and represent Compassionate Basalt, Colorado. You've been talking about an inside and an outside job. Van Johnson talked about it. Almost all of your speakers today have mentioned it.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the dream to rebuild America, the rebuilding the American dream as being an umbrella organization. Let me suggest something from the inside, which is foundational. And it moves us away from this helplessness and despair, this meme of fear and ignorance that we were fed intentionally during the Bush administration. It's a public health issue right now. People are emotionally drained I think in many ways emotionally ill. It's like we are all in this clinical depressive state. And we need a new starting point, a new place to start from instead of fear.
So what's your suggestion for that?
So my suggestion is, Karen Armstrong won a TED Prize in 2008, and the prize was for an idea that could change the world. And her idea was, what if we all make a conscious commitment to the ethic of reciprocity? It's a universal concept across time, across all political divides, across geography. It doesn't matter if you're poor or rich. It doesn't matter if you're left, right. It doesn't matter if you're religious or secular. That idea of always treating all others as you wish to be treated yourself is a universal principle and goal across the globe.
The golden rule. Are you familiar with the anthropological concept of potlatch societies?
Yes.
Okay, so you know what I'm talking about.
And we share the language. It brings us back to that point as a starting point instead of fear, instead of dog eat dog. Well, she, out of Karen's idea, she set up a website, and you can go on and become an individual signatory to the Charter for Compassion, which was written by a group of intellectual, ethical, spiritual leaders from all over the globe.
Right.
You can become an individual
signatory. That's great. Very quickly, what's the website?
The website is charterforcompassion.org.
Okay,
but then there's also a corollary called the Compassionate Cities. I'm part of the second city that became a compassionate city, and there are 52 around the globe that are right now planning to become part of it.
That's great. Maria, I want to get a few more callers in here. How do people find this? What should they search for?
First, charterforcompassion.org.
Okay, just start from there and go for it. Marie, thank you so much for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Kim in Lincoln Park, New Jersey. Kim, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. It's just something popped in my head, and I was thinking about government wanting to privatize just about everything in our lives these days.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear your last sentence.
Our government is trying to just about privatize everything in our lives these days.
Oh, trying to privatize everything, yes.
Yeah, if they want to do that, they should just stop casting us. What are we paying for?
Yeah. Well, what they're doing is they're privatizing the military, for example, and it costs a whole lot more money. Of course, it makes a lot of money for the DeVos family and Eric Prince and whatnot. And then they charge us taxes for it. You're right. Interesting point, Kim. Thank you very much for sharing that. Bob in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First time, long time.
Thank you.
I would just like to add that when we say they, we talk about the government. The government that we have right now is the government of the banksters. You know, almost 100% of the Republicans, 100% of the Republicans and a lot of the corporate Democrats, you know, they get all their funding from Wall Street. And so when we say they, we got to be very careful when we're, you know, bundling the they when we talk about the government.
Yep.
And I want to add also that our President Barack Obama gets this whiny kind of stuff from the left. And it feeds right into the propaganda that the right puts out. And I hope my brothers on the left would just quit that and realize that our loving president is in a pickle there with all those.
He's in a horrible situation. And again, instead of being the circular firing squad, we need to be the wind behind his back. And right across the board. And there are a lot of good politicians. Jan Schakowsky, for example, who was just on this show, is one of them. Excellent point, Bob. Thank you for calling and making it. From Bob to Bob, I don't have your city, though. Where are you from, Bob?
Los Angeles, California.
Hey, so what's up?
I've been going down to the Occupy LA, and I'm so impressed with the youth and how astute and politically aware people are. I've been talking to people. It's great to go down there. We've been supporting it. But I also recently had a Take Back the American Dream meeting, and it seems Van Jones and Move On and other organizations involved in that, the unions, are trying to steer the American Dream movement into a Obama support network at some point. And I'm disturbed by that. I think we need to have a separate movement. I think we need to be in the streets throwing these youth and be out there. I'm 60 years old, and I haven't seen this in years.
This is not an Obama support movement. Now, it may be that a lot of people within the movement think that having a Democratic president is better than a Republican president, the lesser of two evils, or a wonderful president, however you may consider it. But I can tell you, you know, firsthand, the Take Back the American Dream movement, the Reclaim the American Dream, ReclaimTheDream.com, is not about that. So, anyhow, we'll be back tomorrow, once again, from the Take Back the American Dream conference here in Washington, D.C. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.